Have you ever wanted to know what makes something trend?
I think it's a combination of algorithms, consumption habits, and new media organizations.
How often are commercial elements at play in viral stories?
You know, television advertising is dead and internet advertising is the thing. We're going to make a YouTube video like the one these kids are making.
Plus, when you get trolled for dancing, but end up as the feel-good story of the year.
And I didn't realise they were taking photographs, but what they'd done, they'd mocked me, whatever, and I just got a bit down about it. But then underneath, I saw all these comments, and then at the bottom of it was a come to LA and these 1,500 women will throw a party for you, basically.
The History of the Internet.
Welcome to The History of the Internet, a series exploring the trends that started online that now dominate the way we carry out our day-to-day lives. I'm Jamie Wareham. Season 1 of The History of the Internet is brought to you by The Memo, making the future more human. Check out more about this series on their site, thememo.com, right now. We've explored hashtags and visual memes so far, and this week we're going to go one further and look at the internet trend and ask that ultimate question: how does it all go viral?
Chocolate rain. Some stay dry and others feel the pain. Chocolate rain.
Charlie, that really hurt.
Charlie bit me.
And how fucking dare anyone out there make fun of Britney after all she's been through? She's a human!
So what are viral trends? Well, I guess the ones that are the most memorable are the ones that the digital media brands in particular take pride in finding and writing up for you. Maggie Van Eyck is the BuzzFeed UK social media editor.
I think like a lot of the sort of like viral news stories that we write about are kind of one-off like big things, and often they're based on like a single image on Facebook or a single video. And that's different because they don't really last as long. People kind of consume them and then they're like, oh, onto the next cute video, or onto the next dog that's doing a trick on Facebook. So I feel like those type of stories don't last as long as a meme, whereas a meme can last for ages, which is why Tumblr has their own meme librarian, because they have someone to like catalogue memes to like keep in check where they've come from.
So I guess the most important question to ask at even a basic level is what makes for a good viral news story?
You know, I can't help thinking about the Roman Arch and how that really went viral.
Michelle Noble, researcher and scholar that focuses on new literacies and digital technologies.
But a lot of that was to do with, you know, invasions and colonisation and the fact that it worked. So perhaps that's all part of the context of a trend. You know, I think it's a confluence of a whole bunch of things, whether we're talking about online trends, often reflecting what's happening in the real world, but it's this whole confluence of ideas, of resources that you can follow up with, that you can talk to others about, that you can perhaps comment on or have your own beliefs swayed.
So basically what Michelle is getting at is that we share things and stories go viral when people want to talk about them. So I guess let's get into this week's timeline. And no, we're not going to try and document every single trend. They just come and go too quickly for that. It would take forever. We're going to look instead at one of the most iconic trends, the Harlem Shake, which, of course, was also a meme. And yet again, the timeline features the Super Bowl in 2013 as a pinnacle moment, which, if you haven't listened to episodes 1 and 2, was also an important part of the hashtags and memes story too. By the way, X-Files sidestep here. It's honestly got me wondering whether if that blackout had never happened, I'd even be doing the series. Like, I can almost imagine the Family Guy episode where Stewie and Brian travel back in time and literally break the internet. Way before Kim Kardashian ever had the chance. Right, back to it. Let me introduce Kevin Ashton. He wrote an extensive article for The Advocate documenting the rise and fall of the Harlem Shake, which if you believe is some kind of organic, beautiful internet thing, it's time to turn away. This might break you a little.
On January 30th, 2013, a Japanese-American college student named George Miller, with an already popular YouTube channel, posted a 3.5-minute compilation video. This compilation began with 19 seconds of Pink Guy, where he wears a pink bodysuit who dances and pratfalls.
You know, the Harlem Shake, which, you know, for people who don't remember, it came and went very quickly. was kind of a goofy dance that people filmed themselves doing to a particular song called The Harlem Shake, and they posted the video on YouTube.
He got three friends to join him. The song they use is the little-known Harlem Shake by a DJ called Harry Rodriguez, or Bauer.
In fact, of the whole video, Miller's audience loved those 19 seconds, and within hours, one fan posted a video that looped the 19-second sequence for 3.5 minutes.
On February 2nd, Miller reacts to the surge of interest in the start of his video and posts all 36 seconds he originally recorded. Five teenage longboarders from Oz imitate the video.
And then longboarding friends in Florida also imitated their Aussie buddies' video, posting the Harlem Shake version 2. Some of them hadn't even seen the original Pink Guy version.
One of the things that made that possible was people had started getting a habit of videoing themselves doing things and posting it online. A few years earlier, no one would have thought to do that, right? Here's a video of me doing something foolish. I'm going to share it publicly.
February 3rd, Oreos steal the hashtag game during the Super Bowl blackout.
Yes, the Super Bowl, again. Which, if we haven't stressed enough yet, is a huge pinpoint for many internet phenomenons. Forbes called it the Super Bowl of real-time marketing. And now with Kevin, he's going to explain why it's so important.
In the 20th century, in the US particularly, the Super Bowl became this kind of weird pinnacle of television advertising, very much a 20th century marketing tool. And then there was a blackout during the halftime show, the power went out, and a number of advertisers sort of jumped online and quickly tried to come up with something they could communicate that was related to the fact there was a Super Bowl blackout, because nobody was watching the television because there was nothing really much going on. And I think probably the impact of that was very overblown. But the day after the Super Bowl, the story became about what people had done on social media to advertise their brands rather than what people had done during their television.
Basically, brands were desperately looking for the next big thing.
February 7th, the sixth Harlem Shake video appears from YouTube production company Maker Studios and Time Warner after seeing the longboarders on Reddit. Their company uploads a video of their office doing Harlem Shake.
Then a music blogger linked the music and DJ Bauer. The music label started to promote and spread the trend too. Yes, as a way of selling the record, believe it or not, but also because they got a share of any ad revenue linked to it through the YouTube plays.
Most of those videos were people who one way or another were trying to make money out of YouTube videos. And of course, the advertising agencies are on the phone saying, hey, you know, we've got an idea for how you can use social media. And so on that Monday, when people are like, we're going to make sure you, our client, get to take advantage of the next big trend, the thing that looked like it might be the next trend was the Harlem Shake.
February 10th, big brands start to jump on board thinking they've seen the next big thing. February 13th. It becomes uncool as killer of all memes, the Today Show pitches in and hosts Al Roker dance to Harlem Shake in a Cupid costume.
We have seen just about enough of that. That is the world premiere of the Harlem Shake Today Show edition. recorded with obviously no concern for embarrassment a short time ago. And we're going to tell you more about that dance craze that is apparently sweeping the nation. At least that's what they tell us.
But we just put the brakes on it.
Exactly. Back now at 8 o'clock on a Wednesday morning. It's the 13th.
March 19th. It became annoying. Well, maybe not exactly this date, but it is the day that this video was posted.
Shut up, Adam Shake! I said do it! You're not doing it right!
You're insane.
Yes, I know.
And I can assure you, the whole cafeteria was unimpressed. Poor kid.
Somebody do the Harlem Shake! Anybody!
No.
Nobody!
You're insane.
Nobody!
So what have we learned from the Harlem Shake? It was popular because it felt organic, viral, and true to the hearts of those that love it as an internet phenomenon. But it was actually driven by a push to make money out of songs on YouTube's ad revenue system, and by companies and advertising agencies who wanted to bring their clients into the digital marketing age. And that's why the Super Bowl is such an important point in the history of the social internet. It's the time when international brands literally woke up to its significance. So let's pick out two crucial factors: the sense of being organic and the power of money.
I would think if you would dig into it more, the more you would realize that a lot of things that go viral were pushed by corporations to get there.
The voice of Bad Luck Brian meme, Kyle Edwards.
And we just don't realize it, or, you know, we don't care to know, and we just enjoy it and go on with our day, you know? And I think if you would sit back and try to really think about it and look into it, you would be more disappointed than not, so.
And if you're disappointed, that's a key consideration when delivering a satisfying piece of viral content. If it promises to be the best, most amazing thing you've ever seen, ever, like ever, then it probably should be. And if the word promoted or sponsored is also attached to it, that's almost as dirty as the word corporation.
You want to always feel like you're not getting a quick one pulled on you, a quick one pulled over on you. So I understand what they're there and that they are promoted. But, you know, it's just like watching TV with advertisements or radio and advertisements on there. It's going to happen anywhere you go. And, you know, they're going to figure it out one way or another to put it in there and plug it into the viewer.
So here's the compromise and the cliche: content remains king. People don't mind seeing brands so long as they're loving what they're consuming. So it doesn't have to be completely at the other side of the spectrum either and be 100% organic and real.
A lot of like prank videos that go viral, they're always fake. There's 99% of those videos are fake. They always hire actors to do the videos. But, you know, people enjoy them still. You know, it's not so much that it has to be organic. It's better that it's organic, I guarantee that, but it doesn't have to be for it to go viral and people to enjoy it.
Okay, so organic is a friendly word, sponsored and promoted is less so. The reason the Bad Luck Brian meme went so viral and has remained a popular meme is because it's relatable. You can listen to more about that in episode 2, though. The trouble with being purely organic, of course, is how one thing can be relatable to everyone. And that's where understanding how social media algorithms count. Because as defined by Martin Raymond in the Trend Forecaster's book, at its most basic, a trend can be defined as the direction in which something, indeed anything, tends to move and has a consequential impact on culture, society, or business through the way it moves. And that's what we're going to explore next, when humans get involved and how that has an impact on the trends we have.
My name is Sean O'Brien. I've become a bit of an internet sensation last year and became known as the Dancing Man.
Sean saw firsthand the good, bad and ugly of an internet trend after he was trolled dancing in a video.
Well, I was just out on a night out with a few friends and a few photographs were taken of me with a few lads who were trying to make fun of me. These were picked up by a group of girls in LA who invited me over to LA for a dance party.
But that doesn't quite do it justice. This was no ordinary party, and it actually started with some malicious posts that went very viral.
It was all about body shaming, yeah. Well, it was. I was kind of dancing, and just as we always do, just having a good time, laughing and joking. And I didn't realise they were taking photographs, but what they'd done, they'd mocked me and whatever, and I just got a bit down about it. And then they'd taken a few pictures of the before and after. And under the second one, they put a comment of seeing this specimen dancing. He saw us laughing at him and kind of as if to mock me for being a bit upset. But I don't know, the joke turned on them, I suppose, didn't it? I wasn't on social media, so I wouldn't have never known about it until a friend rang me up on the Friday and just said, sent me a link and said, you better have a look at this. He said, your face is all over the internet. And you know, the first thing I thought was, oh, what have I done here? And what have I been up to? But then underneath, I saw all these comments and all these phrases and all these well wishes saying, oh, don't worry about it, be yourself. And then at the bottom of it was a come to LA and these 1,500 women will throw a party for you, basically. Well, Well, the party was great. It was in centre of LA. Moby headed the DJ with Tropical. There was speeches by Monica Lewinsky, Andrew WK. The LA Dodgers presented me a baseball shirt on there and told me I was throwing the first pitch the following day. And there was 1,400 people attended it in the end. Initially it was all meant to be me and girls whenever, but we turned it into just a party for anybody. We had Miss Wheelchair America attend. We had a guy called Matt Diaz, who'd been a lot overweight, and he was having some weight taken off him. And Justin Dennis, who was a transsexual. And it was really good.
Sean's now a campaigner for Cybersmile, Kidscape and the Diana Trust. But how do we find out about videos like Sean? As we touched upon earlier, many of them are showcased by digital media brands, and that's where Storyful come in. They propel stories with the potential to go viral up the scale by using algorithms to find them and then, crucially, humans to verify and curate them before sending them off to the many journalists that use their service.
Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Vice, Mashable, ABC News.
Rahul Chopra, CNN. CEO of Storyful.
And what we're doing is distilling trillions and trillions of social posts that are hitting every major social platform around the world, looking for when clusters of people begin to talk about something that's relevant to one of our news partners. And when something like that occurs, it's our newsroom that then jumps in, discovers what it is exactly that's happening, validates the authenticity of it, clears the rights, and then gets it in the hands of our news partners as quickly as possible to use or leverage.
So basically, their tech sucks up data from user-generated sites. But even their powerful algorithms have limitations.
There are many aspects of what technology can do that can replace a lot of the lifting and efforts that our newsroom put in.
But ultimately, until technology can develop empathy, Storyful will continue to employ staff to sift and validate the content that gets sent out on their viral newswire, which then goes to newsrooms, who write stories around the content, only to fight again with the algorithms to get the story back to you. And when I say algorithms in plural, I really only mean just one.
More and more, it's becoming maybe the most important algorithm in the world.
Because with 1.71 billion active users as of June 2016, Facebook's EdRank has power over what a lot of people do and don't see in their timeline.
And these algorithms are determining exactly what we're looking at on a daily basis, whether that be posts from our friends, editorial content, news content, and deciding what's relevant or not to those people. So in some ways, it's creating a very closed ecosystem in regards to what we see and don't see, placing an importance on content that could determine our views, decision-making, etc., based on that.
And that's why Facebook is always in the news, whether it's even fake news, buying WhatsApp or Instagram, or for what they're planning to do with your data next. But this episode is about trending. So let's have a look back at when they were in the news for their trending feature. And it got them into a little bit of a storm in 2016.
Well, Facebook under fire, the social media site now accused of conservative censorship.
A technology website quotes former contractors as saying, quote, Facebook routinely suppressed news stories of interest to conservative readers.
Tonight, a top Senate Republican is demanding to know how that list is compiled.
If the news that's coming through there, which is represented to be objective, and it's not, then I think the people deserve the right to know that.
It's a story that has a lot of people talking. The company is now responding.
That's just some of the coverage from the likes of CNN, Fox, and NBC, which all began after Gizmodo's exclusive interview with a former Facebook staffer on the trending team. He alleged that they worked subjectively. Facebook, of course, denied any accusations that trending had any bias, and have since said that the algorithm would now select trending topics in place of humans doing that. But human editors would still screen them. But this intense focus on the platform goes way beyond viral news. It also says a lot about the way we consume video and media now. Rahul Chopra from Storyful again.
I think it's a combination of algorithms, consumption habits, and new media organizations. 80% of the internet today is user-generated content. There's a great deal of content being created, more content that's being created today than there has been before. It's not like there's one piece of content that's beginning to trend, and then that's the video that or photo that everyone is talking about. There's, at any given point, hundreds or thousands of these videos that are beginning to do anywhere from 10 to 100 million streams in regards to people watching it.
So I guess, you know, one of the interesting things you can get from that is how the YouTube era is very different to the broadcast television era.
Kevin Ashton, from our Harlem Shake timeline earlier.
I have three children there, you know, between 10 and 13. Somebody asked me the other day, what do your kids watch on TV? This is someone who has no children. I was like, my kids don't watch TV. They might watch a couple of shows on Netflix, but basically they watch YouTube. This was incomprehensible to this 30-something-year-old person. That's how the internet has, one of the ways the internet has changed the spread of information.
And Kevin is also the man that coined the term the Internet of Things. And that's why he's so interested in the trends that we follow. Because more and more, not only algorithms, but computers are going to be making decisions on our behalves. Next time on the history of the internet. Teaser is inbound on the crazy, creepy, and scary internet devices sucking up our social interactions and human behaviours in episode 4. But first, a quick run through the credits. Season 1 of the History of the Internet podcast is supported by TheMemo.com. Go over there right now and check out loads more editorial and stories around the themes in this very series. They are all about writing and covering stories that will shape us so we can make the future more human. And I love reading this stuff. With thanks to Alice Taplin for voicing today's timeline. Creative Commons music comes from Purple Planet Music, both our theme Hard Trance and the timeline Mousetrap. Plus, The Machine Thinks by Kevin McLeod and Welcome by Cyber SDF. We now usually tell everyone to head over to our Twitter at internet_pod or even our Instagram with the same handle. You can even find us on Facebook, but ahead of an episode on the Internet of Things. We thought you should go check out the Twitter account at Internet of Shit, and you'll be well primed to understand the pain one guest has next week for our future. If you're loving the podcast series so far, remember you can even help us beat those internet giants that control podcasts. One way is to go to your Apple Podcast app, or our iTunes feed, and help us beat the algorithms by rating, subscribing, and reviewing this very podcast. In fact, do it wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us put this show in front of more eyes and ears. Don't forget, you can even get in touch with the show old school with our Hotmail account at internet_pod@hotmail.com. I'm your presenter and producer, Jamie Wareham. Send me gifts at Jamie_Wareham on Twitter. That's all I use Twitter for. And now let's hear a cheeky tease of next week's show.
For me, an artificial intelligence or one of the most potentially, come back to this word joy, you know, joyful applications, is to be in two places at once. Things like form filling, you know, tax returns, things like car tax. You know, if all of those, if we can create tiny shards of our personality, micro clones of ourselves and delegate some level of authority to them and let them take care of those things on our behalf, that's a hugely exciting prospect for me.
Hashtag internet bants.